Today is the third day of this June 2013 six-day session, and we're going to continue to read from Tracing Back the Radiance, Chinnell's Korean Way of Zen by Robert E. Buswell, Jr. And we're reading from a chapter called Secrets on Cultivating the Mind. Question. You talked about seeing the nature, but when there is true seeing of the nature, the person becomes an enlightened saint and should be able to perform magic and miracles. He would be different from other people. How is it then that among those who cultivate mind nowadays, not one can display these spiritual powers and transformation bodies? These spiritual powers, this questioner is referring to, are things like clairvoyance, seeing into past lives, one's own and others, being able to be in two places at once. We could say that this questioner is suffering from a bit of spiritual materialism. He's wanting to see some tangible evidence of awakening in saints in this community. Chunul replies with some fairly stiff criticism. He says, "You should not utter absurdities lightly. To be unable to differentiate the perverse from the noble is to be deluded and confused. Nowadays, you people who are training on the path chat about the truth with your mouth, but in your minds you only shrink from it and end up falling into the error of underestimating yourselves by thinking that you do not share in the Buddha nature. This is all that you are doubting. You train on the path, but you do not know the proper sequence of practice. You talk but do not distinguish the root from the branches. This is called wrong view. It is not called cultivation. You are not only deceiving yourselves, you are deceiving others too. How can you not be on your guard against this?" He really comes to the crux of the matter, and he says, "You underestimate yourself by thinking that you do not share in the Buddha nature." He continues. "Now, there are many approaches to the path, but essentially they are included in the twofold approach of sudden awakening and gradual cultivation. Although sudden cultivation has been advocated, this is the entrance for people of the highest faculties. If you were to probe their pasts, you would see that their cultivation has been based for many lives on the insights gained in a previous awakening. Now, in this life, after gradual permeation, these people hear the Dharma and awaken. In one instant, their practice is brought to a sudden conclusion. But if we try to explain this according to the facts, then sudden awakening, sudden cultivation, is also the result of an initial awakening and its subsequent cultivation. Consequently, this twofold approach of sudden awakening and gradual cultivation is the track followed by thousands of saints. Hence, if all the saints of old, there were none who did not first have an awakening, subsequently cultivate it, and finally, because of their cultivation, gain realization." And we've touched on this a little before, but this was the core of his training method, of Chinnell's training method, was to keep these two things of sudden and gradual together in the way that he trained his monks. And his emphasis was on the training that has to happen after an awakening, to make that awakening real in our lives, to actualize it. He says in about this monk that he doesn't know the proper sequence of practice. It's mistaken to think that a kensho is going to turn you into a saint. Kenshos are going to help to clarify the work that we have to do. The so-called magic and miracles you mentioned manifest because of the gradual permeation of cultivation based on an initial awakening. It should not be said that they appear simultaneous with that awakening. As it is said in the sutras, the noumenon is awakened to suddenly and is forged in accordance with this awakening. Phenomena cannot be removed suddenly. They are brought to an end step by step. Throughout this text, Buswell uses this term, noumenon. And he's really using it for the absolute, the ineffable. Noumenon is often contrasted with phenomenon. In other words, what can be apprehended by our ordinary senses. So another way of saying it would be mind with a capital M. Of course, these two, noumenon and phenomenon, are not separate. But we need to find ways to refer to this ineffable truth. We could say here, we could rephrase it, the absolute is awakened to suddenly and is forged in accordance with this awakening. Then phenomena cannot be removed suddenly. They are brought to an end step by step. This is the gradual training. Even after we have seen into our true nature, we still have habits. And our habits we purify step by step. Then he gives a beautiful analogy here to illustrate what he's trying to say. This is from a master called Kuei Feng, who was both a Chan master and a master of the Hua Yan school, which was so influential on Chinnell. Although we know that a frozen pond is entirely water, the sun's heat is necessary to melt it. Although we awaken to the fact that an ordinary man is Buddha, the power of Dharma is necessary to make it permeate our cultivation. When that pond has melted, the water flows freely and it can be used for irrigation and cleaning. When falsity is extinguished, the mind will be numinous and dynamic, and then its function of penetrating brightness will manifest. So although we may awaken to the fact that we are Buddhas, we still need what he calls here the power of Dharma to have that realization permeate everything. The power of Dharma encompasses a lot here. There's the sutras, studying the sutras, upholding the precepts, and a very big part of it is how we relate to each other, how we live in community, how we communicate, how we deal with problems. It would encompass also service to others. All of these things are help us to make the Dharma real in our lives. So really, really what, in response to this question, Chinnell is pointing to the oneness of noumenon and phenomenon. That we have to keep them together and work on both, and that these spiritual powers that the monk would be like to see are a result of a gradual process, a process that takes place over lifetimes. Maybe these spiritual powers can seem a little remote to us, but it is important to understand the role of karma in our training. Sometimes we might feel that we've been working a really long, hard time on a koan. And then we see other people who seem to sail through when compared to us. This was something that irked me when my husband Richard, several years ahead of me, saw into his koan. Was passed, and I felt acutely jealous, especially because I felt that I'd certainly done more sesshins than him, spent more time at the centre, made more sacrifices to be here, and there he was, just but it was actually very, very painful to realise how jealous I felt. Here I was chanting, may all beings attain Buddhahood every day, and yet I resented the fact that my own husband was closer to Buddhahood. So painful to see that in myself. But it comes down to karma. You could say that he at that moment in time had more spiritual power due to his past actions. Spiritual power comes from living skillfully, from living in a wholesome way, from virtue. The classic way this is talked about in Buddhism is as merit. From the absolute point of view, we're all the same. We're all exactly the same. Our true nature is completely pure and undefiled. And we all have the same true nature. But from a relative point of view, we do have more or less merit depending on how much we have engaged in virtue and wholesome acts in the past. This says absolutely nothing about who we are intrinsically, but it is the law of cause and effect. So we can always remedy this. So maybe we for as a result of things we don't even know happened in previous lives, have to struggle now. There's no way around that. We struggle. But we can also really put energy into living wholesomely, contributing. Developing virtue, developing that spiritual power. We can do that. We can cultivate in all these different ways. We don't have to dwell on what might or might not have happened in our distant pasts. We don't have to concern ourselves with that. All we have to do is deal with what's in front of us. But accept that whatever we have to deal with is a result of previous causes. The fact that it is anything that is going on means it's a result of previous causes. So we deal with it. We work with whatever our karmic circumstances are. Let me just read that passage about the frozen pond again. Although we know that a frozen pond is entirely water, the sun's heat is necessary to melt it. Although we awaken to the fact that an ordinary man is Buddha, the power of Dharma is necessary to make it permeate our cultivation. When that pond has melted, the water flows freely and can be used for irrigation and cleaning. When falsity is extinguished, the mind will be numinous and dynamic, and then its function of penetrating brightness will manifest. Chinnell then adds, these quotations should make it clear that the ability to perform magic and miracles in the phenomenal sphere cannot be perfected in a day. It will manifest only after gradual permeation. Moreover, in the case of accomplished men, phenomenal spiritual powers are like an eerie apparition. They are only a minor concern of saints. Although they might perform them, they do not give them undue emphasis. In fact, there are rules even in classical Buddhism about not showing off one's powers. These powers do exist, but they're the leaves and branches. They're not the essential matter. And to get caught up in them is to be getting distracted from what really is important, which is to find out who and what we are here and now. He continues, nowadays, deluded and ignorant people wrongly assume that in the one moment of awakening, incalculable sublime functions, as well as magic and miracles, manifest in tandem. This is the sort of understanding I was referring to when I said you did not know the proper sequence of practice and did not distinguish the root from the branches. To seek the path to Buddhahood while not knowing the proper sequence of practice or the root and the branches is like trying to put a square peg into a round hole. Can this be anything but a grave mistake? Because such people do not know of any expedience, they hesitate as if they were facing a steep precipice and end up backsliding. Alas, many have broken their ties with the spiritual family of the Buddha in this manner. Since they neither understand for themselves nor believe that others have an understanding and awakening, when they see someone without spiritual powers, they act insolently, ridiculing the sages and insulting the saints. This is really quite pitiful. If we bring down people to our level, people who we think should have more powers, then that kind of takes us off the hook, doesn't it? If we think, oh, it's all a sham. It's also important not to elevate people too much. This can be a problem too. Also, to have overinflated expectations of ourselves. I think it's fair to say that in Zen there is a big emphasis on sudden awakening and gradual cultivation has been neglected. There are parts of Japanese Zen where the precepts are made light of. In this country, there are several Japanese Zen teachers who have been involved in sexual misconduct and alcohol abuse, or both. And we should question this in for ourselves. What is deficient? What was deficient in these teachers' training that led to this? Of course, they bear individual responsibility, but to take these really painful events as warnings and to look at ourselves, to cultivate post-kensho. How are we doing that? How are we continuing that training? We may have we have over-inflated expectations of kensho and then can feel really bad if, after we've passed a certain number of koans and then think I should be feeling better than I am. How come I'm depressed or anxious? I've heard people say we shouldn't talk about that because it might discourage people from seeking kensho. But you could also argue that it's more damaging to put kensho up on a pedestal because it could actually make it harder for people to reach if they think it's some very exalted thing. When in fact what it is, it's is getting a clear glimpse of the fact that I'm a Buddha. Warts and all. Then afterwards, once I've seen that, I'll be able to work on realizing that, actualizing it, with maybe a wee bit more conviction and clarity and joy. But if I don't do that realizing part, then it can turn just into a kind of memory, a present memory, or maybe even a painful memory in the sense of, how do I get back to that? So continuing to sit, to go to Sesshin, to look honestly at our lives, to uphold the precepts, take them seriously. You have said this twofold approach of sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, is the track followed by thousands of saints. But if awakening is really sudden awakening, what need is there for gradual cultivation? And if cultivation means gradual cultivation, how can you speak of sudden awakening? We hope that you will expound further on these two ideas of sudden and gradual and resolve our remaining doubts. Chinnell. First, let us take sudden awakening. When the ordinary man is deluded, he assumes that the four great elements are his body and the false thoughts are his mind. He does not know that his own nature is the true Dharma body. He does not know that his own numinous awareness is the true Buddha. He looks for the Buddha outside his mind. While he is thus wandering aimlessly, the entrance to the road might by chance be pointed out by a wise advisor. If in one thought he then follows back the light of his mind to its source and sees his own original nature, he will discover that the ground of his nature is innately free of defilement and that he himself is originally endowed with the non-outflow wisdom nature, which is not a hair's breadth different from that of all the Buddhas. Hence it is called sudden awakening. So it can happen in an instant if we're just fully turning back our attention, tracing back the radiance, as Chinnell says elsewhere, following back the light of the mind to its source. He uses an unusual term here, to be endowed with the non-outflow wisdom nature. This understanding what is meant by outflows is important. We have these six senses, our five ordinary senses and our conceptual mind. And these are known as the six sense doors, and usually they leak. And what is meant by this is that when we see an object, we think that that object is outside us, and we grasp onto it. We kind of engage psychic energy with that object. And that energy leaks out because we think that that is something that we either have to acquire or hold on to or get rid of. We when we do Zazen, we little by little stop doing that. We stop grasping, pushing away. And it's when we stop doing that, even just for a millisecond, that we then see our wisdom nature, which flows nowhere. There's abundance still. He continues, next let us consider gradual cultivation. Although he has awakened to the fact that his original nature is no different from that of the Buddha's, the beginningless habit energies are extremely difficult to remove suddenly, and so he must continue to cultivate while relying on this awakening. Through this gradual permeation, he endeavors to reach completion. He constantly nurtures the sacred embryo, and after a long time, he becomes a saint. This is called gradual cultivation. Every single one of us is pregnant with this sacred embryo. Just imagine that for a minute. You're pregnant with the sacred embryo. If you know this, if you know you're pregnant, then you're going to do everything you can to eat the right foods, not do unhealthy things or dangerous things. You want to think positive thoughts for the sake of that growing being. If you really, really understand what it is to nurture that embryo, all these things will be things you want to do. It's a long gestation. Lifetimes. Kalpas. He continues, this process can be compared to the maturation of a child. From the day of its birth, a baby is endowed with all the sense organs, just like everyone else, but its strength is not yet fully developed. It is only after many months and years that it will finally become an adult. This is a beautiful, beautiful analogy because it keeps these two sides together, nature and nurture, which are what are behind, really, this whole idea of sudden and gradual. At birth, the baby is fully human. And yet, there is all this development that has to take place for it to come into its own, to be at full strength. We're all on the path to adulthood. Most of us have a long way to be fully adult, to truly stand on our own two feet, not relying on anything. Especially not relying on praise or adulation, gain, success, all of these things that we so often get fooled into thinking that we need in order to be happy. Question: through what expedience is it possible to trace back the radiance of one's sense faculties in one thought and awaken to the self nature? Chinnell: the self nature is just your own mind. What other expedience do you need? If you ask for expedience to seek understanding, you are like a person who, because he does not see his own eyes, assumes that he has no eyes and decides to find some way to see. But since he does have eyes, how else is he supposed to see? If he realizes that in fact he has never lost his eyes, this is the same as seeing his eyes, and no longer would he waste his time trying to find a way to see. How then could we have any thoughts that he could not see? How could he have any thoughts that he could not see? Your own numinous awareness is exactly the same. Since this awareness is your own mind, how else are you going to understand? If you seek some other way to understand, you will never understand. Simply by knowing that there is no other way to understand, you are seeing the nature. There's a saying in Zen, the eye cannot see itself. But when we see our seeing, we're seeing that eye. Question: when the superior man hears Dharma, he understands easily. Average and inferior men, however, are not without doubt and confusion. Could you describe some expedience so that the deluded too can enter into enlightenment? Chinnell: the path is not related to knowing or not knowing. You should get rid of the mind that clings to its delusion and look forward to enlightenment. Listen to me. Before we go on, just to point up this very central piece of advice that Chinnell gives here. You should get rid of the mind which clings to its delusion and looks forward to enlightenment. It's one of these real ironies that we cling to our delusion. Why do we do that? Many of us will have a story we tell us. We may feel like a dark secret that we don't say anything to other people, but we tell ourselves. And it's a story about who we are. One psychologist calls it our core deficit story. And it can come in many forms. It can be I'm not good enough, or I'm unlovable, I'm a failure, I'm a misfit, can have many different tastes and qualities, the story we tell. But it colours everything, all our perceptions. It can be very painful, and yet we cling to it. Perhaps because it gives us a sense of identity that is better than not having one, or seems to be. Because we human beings don't like to not know. It's a passage here from a work of the early Buddhist scholar Edward Conser. According to the views elaborated by Schiller, Freud, Heidegger, and Jaspers, there is in the core of our being a basic anxiety, a little empty hole from which all other forms of anxiety and unease draw their strength. In its pure form, this anxiety is experienced only by people with an introspective and philosophical turn of mind, and even then only rarely. If one has never felt it oneself, no amount of explanation will convince. If one has felt it, one will never forget, however much one may try. It may come upon you when you have been asleep, withdrawn from the world. You wake up in the middle of the night and feel a kind of astonishment at being there, which then gives way to a fear and horror at the mere fact of being there. It is then that you catch yourself by yourself, just for a moment, against a background of a kind of nothingness all around you, and with a gnawing sense of your powerlessness, your utter helplessness in the face of this astonishing fact that you are there at all. Usually we avoid this experience as much as we possibly can, because it is so shattering and painful. Usually I'm very careful not to have myself by myself. But the I, plus all sorts of other experiences, people who are busy all the time, who must always think of something, who must always be doing something, are incessantly running away from this experience of the basic or original anxiety. What we usually do is learn to rely on something else than this empty centre of ourselves. The Buddhist contention is that we will never be at ease before we have overcome this basic anxiety, and that we can do that only by relying on nothing at all. To not know. To not cling to a sense of identity. Nikos Kazantzakis said, "What is our duty? To hold ourselves in front of the abyss with dignity. No tears, no laughter to hide our fear. No closing of the eyes." We'll stop here and recite the four vows.